Good morning, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. Today is Sunday, April 14th, 2024. My name is Melanie C., and I'm a recovered compulsive overeater, and I live in Canby, Oregon. The share ID numbers for Friday, April 12th, 2024, are the following. The 7 a.m. Eastern Time Big Book Study share ID number is 21310. Big Book Study, that share ID number is 21311, 21,311. This morning, A Vision for You presents, How's Your Program Going? Living, Embodying, and Integrating the Steps. We here at A Vision for You are a fellowship of compulsive overeaters reading and studying the directions for recovering from the disease of compulsive overeating from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We read a paragraph or two from the literature, then stop and share on what was read, taking apart the paragraph to its basic recovery component parts and talking about how we implement that into our recovering and recovered lives. We are blessed to hear from all over the world how we have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Does that sound familiar? It is exactly what we read every single day, but we embody this, we're living this, and we're integrating the steps each and every day of our lives. It is all covered within the pages of the Big Books of Alcoholics Anonymous. How is that to be for compulsive overeaters? Well, you're going to hear more about that today. How blessed we are that as a compulsive overeater and undereaters, we have a program that works for all of us. Well, how many times have we asked ourselves the question, how in the world can I fit a program of recovery into my already jam-packed life? I cannot even manage what I'm doing and what's going on now. And am I to put program first above all these things? I simply cannot. The beauty of these questions to self is that we do not struggle with it. It is a process and journey of recovery that happens to us, to our hearts, to our souls, to the regeneration and the rebirth. It straightens us out. It aligns us with power and puts us on the pathway to a new way of living. It replaces the old with a functioning new. It becomes our life of quality and freedom. It is a parallel life sidled right next to the addictive fear of old living. It's a parallel life right to that that we can help us keep in check. And that parallel part will not be healed. However, we stay sober, step by step, daily cultivating this new way of living given to us happily. The quality of our program is up to us. The terms, not so hard after all. Measure it up against where we were, what it was like, and the miracle of abstinence, a higher power doing for us what we cannot or would not do for ourselves, a level of purpose and usefulness that has us on our knees with gratitude. It is our life. We embrace this way of living like no other. We held on to that life preserver and we got well. The quality, integrity, respect, and honor of others outside ourselves and before ourselves comes to life. A true standard of living to follow. We got better. As we got better, those around us got better. We were less self-centered, less selfish day by day. The high highs and the low lows became balanced out. We held tight and internalized this as a precious gift, and we share this freely. And what does it take? A power greater than ourselves that promises a recovered life, a band of fellows surrounding us, embodying and integrating the steps daily and freely giving away what we have so generously been given. Today, A Vision for You is so excited to present two very visually, enthusiastically, deeply involved recovered compulsive overeaters brimming with excitement to share with you their wealth of wisdom born of growth. And sometimes that growth was very painful through the 12-step process that they embody and respect each and every day. And to tell you how daily this is the way of living that truly, truly works. You know these two quite well. They are extremely active in A Vision for You and in their own communities, be it local or virtual communities, sharing this good news for free and for the love and fun of it. They are here to pass on to you a piece of their heart and their recovery so that you too can have what we all have. They will share with you their playbook. Awesome, right? Imagine that. So let's get these two up here to the mic and begin this wonderful time together focused on recovery. Please help me extend a traditional, warm, and exuberant welcome to Jason KP from Pennsylvania and Melissa C. from New York. Good morning, good morning.
Good morning, Melanie. Thank you so much for that enthusiastic and great introduction. And I'll just speak briefly before I introduce Melissa. My name is Jason KP. I'm a recovered compulsive eater and bulimic living here in Pennsylvania, just outside of Philadelphia, with a little bit over 6.5 years of recovery, living in a healthy body and at a normal weight, quote unquote normal weight. Just want to invite us to reflect first this morning. I just want to ask a few questions about our own experience and just to see if we've had a revolutionary spiritual experience, and has this experience changed our whole attitude towards life, towards our fellows, and towards God's universe? And if you haven't, can you envision that? And if you've had this, or if you can envision it, how does it our life look differently, our work life, our family life, our daily life, even some mundane tasks? Do we act differently, even when they're in the car, in the grocery store, in our kitchen, doing dishes? Does that experience integrate into every part of our life? And if you haven't had that, can you imagine how an experience like that would integrate into your entire life? That's going to be the topic of our discussion today. This talk was an organic idea and sort of an organic conversation between myself and Melissa. I'd get asked this question sometimes, how is your program? And I'd be a little taken aback by this, almost confused, because in my mind I'd be like, you know, my life, like every part of my life, there wasn't and isn't a strong conscious separation in my mind between my program and my life. And I could really relate to that idea. So our title today is, How's Your Program? Living, Embodying, and Integrating the Steps. So I'm going to let Melissa talk, getting some quotes and being very systematic. She's going to go into this topic for like the next 15, 20, 25 minutes and share her deep experience with this. And then she's going to pass the ball to me, and I'm going to talk about my experience and some big book quotes and some reflections. And then we're going to open up for questions and then answers. So, Melissa, why don't you take it away from here?
Yeah, hey, thank you. Thanks so much, Jason. Thank you, Melanie, as well. My name is Melissa C. I'm a recovered compulsive overeater. I live in New York, and it's a pleasure to be here. And like Jason was saying, he and I, you know, we talk from time to time, not all the time, but like many of the fellows in this program, we pick up the phone, we make calls to each other, and there's this very natural, organic connection that just happens, and you get like right to the heart of things so fast. And we just found ourselves talking about that question that we get asked, you know, like, how's your program doing? And you know, we were kind of like almost laughing, saying it's sort of like, I think it's almost like asking me, how's your oxygen? How's the water? You know, like, because it really has integrated into just my natural part. It's as essential to my living as drinking water and breathing air, and I can't necessarily separate program from my life. And so, just a quick background on who I am and what brings me here is I was crushed by this disease. I lived in a state of constant battle with the food. I could never eat enough to satisfy what I wanted, and I could never get my body to look the way that I wanted it to look, as though I didn't have this problem. And I had a lot of knowledge about the foods that were problematic for me, and I would attempt to put them down periods of my life. I was always on a diet, always, always on a diet, and I was always regaining the weight. So I never stayed at a normal, healthy body weight. I never had peace from the food. It was a constant source of angst in my life, and I thought that was my only problem. I had no idea that the structure and the way that I had been living my life, basically the program of my life, was faulty. I didn't know that. You know, I thought it was just a food problem. Until I came, you know, to the end of me. And I'm so grateful for this particular meeting, because prior to coming here, I had some great, wonderful help along the way, like in other iterations of Overeaters Anonymous. But what I got there was an idea, and maybe that was just my false idea, that I could be a Saturday morning meeting person and then live the rest of my life the way that I wanted and then just sort of roll in every Saturday morning and sort of dump my crap. That was how I wanted to live my program. And basically what I said was, back for a long time, what I really wanted was OA light. I wanted OA light, and OA light for someone like me doesn't exist. I needed actually a full-on restructuring of everything. And I came to this particular meeting, and I've been recovered now. It's over 10 years, and I've lived in a normal, healthy body weight. I've released over 160 pounds. I am less than half of the size that I was when I came, and I've lived this way peacefully, joyously. You know, I could pinch myself. I can't believe that I am living inside this body in this period of time with this level of freedom. So that's what brings me here. and so... there's a quote that I love. There's a solution. It's on page 25, and this really is the foundation of this talk. The great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and towards God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. And so if you've had a revolution, you know, with this internal revolution, which I'll get back to it, it means that every aspect of my life, you know, the old leadership per se, which was me and my selfish needs, have been like lovingly or not so lovingly overthrown and like rejected, sent out. And that what takes place is a brand new attitude, a brand new way of interacting with my entire life, with fellows, yes, but with all of God's universe. And I think, like, God's universe? Yes. Even the aspects of this world that I have yet to see and have direct contact with, I have a different attitude towards. I know my small place, and I just seek to be helpful. That's really it. And what I say is that if you've had an experience where your Creator has entered into your heart, what happens is, you know, when God entered my heart, the things that I long to do become the things that I have to do. That's miraculous. I also love, besides loving the big book, I'm a lover of the AA 12 and 12. And if you look at step 12 in the AA 12 and 12, it really talks about the practical application of this, of these steps into your life. And so page 111, if you have the AA 12 and 12, it says this: now comes the biggest question yet. What about the practice of these principles in all our affairs? Can we love the whole pattern of living as eagerly as we do the small segment of it we discover when we try to help other alcoholics achieve sobriety? So it doesn't say, can you tolerate, like, the pattern of living, but can you actually love? And, you know, I have to say, like, I love the work I do in the fellowship. This is a joy for me to get up on a Sunday morning and get to talk and get to share what God has done for me. It is like, I love doing this, you know, whether it's talks, meetings, sponsoring, like running workshops, those things fill me. But can I love the rest of my life, you know? And I have to say, I have fallen in love with my job, like in a whole new way. 26 years in being a second grade teacher, I love it more and more and more, which is so opposite of, I have to say, sadly, of many of the professionals that I work with. Like, you know, we're getting towards the end of our careers, and many of them are, you know, just sort of dragging themselves through it. I don't have that experience, you know. I would say even the mundane tasks of being a wife and a mother and a homeowner, like I'm actually loving many of those tasks. I, through recovery, I actually discovered I love to mow the lawn. Like, I enjoy it. It's not drudgery for me. Doing laundry, it no longer feels beneath me or like too much for me to do. You know, I find myself more and more doing things without needing an award or even an acknowledgement. You know, there was a time when I would say, like, I wanted a parade and a medal for doing the laundry. Like, I would, you know, I would put my husband's shirts away or my kids' things away, and I would say, I hung up your shirts or I put your clothes in the drawer, like, because I wanted acknowledgement. And now I like a lot, I just do those things because I want to do it. And I actually feel at home inside my own body and inside my own life. Page 112 says this, again in the AA 12 and 12. Can we bring the same spirit of love and tolerance into our sometimes deranged family lives that we bring into our AA group or to our OA group? And, you know, I read this, and what I'm reminded of is it doesn't matter if I have family members that are deranged. Like, that's okay, you know, because I'm the one who decided to turn my will and life over to the care and protection of my Creator. That was my decision. I made it freely. And so in this agreement, you know, in this, it's a covenant. We make a promise with God. Then I get some instructions back. It's like, okay, God, if I'm going to really turn my will and my life over into your care, one of the things I'm instructed is to have love and tolerance. You know, and so love, you know, what is love anyway? Well, love is like, is putting other people's needs ahead of your own. It's doing things out of like complete kindness. It's not holding people, you know, there's no agreement. I do this for you and you do this for me, and I'll withhold love based on, you know, what you didn't do for me last. But it's actual love, and sometimes it means letting people have their space to fall and fail. Like, that sometimes is loving. I'm, you know, it's never my job now to protect people from the consequences of their own decisions. That's actually loving. I don't have to judge them in the process, but I can, you know, and this is really applicable with my children. It means, like, sometimes I just get out of the way, and I, you know, and I don't say I told you so later. And then what is tolerance? You know, what does it mean to have tolerance? It means that I am not so sensitive in watching other people struggle. You know, I have what I like to call a thicker skin. That's the direction I'm given. Love these people and don't be so easily, you know, hurt or set up, you know, or triggered, people say. And, you know, I have a particular family member that I've had problems with over the years. And at times he's actually been pretty verbally abusive, you know, aggressive. He would speak to me in a way that is just disrespectful and not a way that I like. And I actually recently overheard him talking about me, right? Like, I was in a situation and I could hear what he said about me. And yeah, am I supposed, you know, is he deranged? Perhaps. The book says he might just be. But I still have to have love and tolerance for him. And to live this program means, like, I don't retaliate, you know, and I don't discuss it with other family members, and I don't lash out. I can actually give this individual grace. It doesn't mean I'm a doormat, because the other thing I've learned in recovery is there is a delicate balance, you know. And in the big book, it says on page 83 that we should be sensible, tactful, considerate and humble without being servile or scraping. That as God's people, we stand on our feet and we don't crawl before anyone. Now, I know that in that part of the book, they were talking about when you go before somebody and make amends. But my program is not separate from the way that I live my life. And those are pretty good directions. Like, I can be sensible, tactful, and considerate and humble, but I don't have to kiss the ground that people walk on. And I'm not, you know, when it says not being servile, you know, it means like I don't have an excessive willingness to serve or please others in a subservient, groveling manner, you know. And so I've had a situation even at work where, you know, I had to sort of give someone some grace, give some leeway. Again, it was someone who spoke to me in a way that I didn't like, I thought was aggressive, that, you know, raised her voice at me. And I can merely, you know, I can actually say in this program, excuse me, you may not speak to me like that. And if you're going to speak to me like that, I'm ending the conversation. And we can talk later when you're ready to speak to me in a manner that's dignified and respectful. And then I can walk away. But it doesn't mean that I gather up my troops and I tell a million other people what she said and what she did. And I ask God through my daily prayer to help me understand what may have brought this individual, just like my other family member, to that level of where they felt so pressed that that was the way that they responded, right? And can we have the same kind of confidence and faith in these people who have been infected and sometimes crippled by our own illness that we have in our sponsors? Can we actually carry the AA spirit into our daily work? And so to me, the AA spirit means a spirit of surrendered. You know, in the world to play the role he assigned me, which means no fixing, no managing, no controlling, having enthusiasm and a sincere desire to be helpful, one among many, but taking the lead when there's work to be done, to be of service to serve and not perform. And that's how I look to do my job today. And can we meet our newly recognized responsibilities to the world at large? You know, what are my newly recognized responsibilities? You know, I used to think that this referred only to sponsorship or program-based service, right? And that would mean that I would have two lives, my program life versus my real life. And today I know that it means, you know, for me, what does that mean? It means I have a mom with dementia, so it means that caring for my mom at times. It means for me, the demographics of where I teach has changed, and so I have more and more students that have newly arrived to this country. And so my newly recognized responsibilities is learning Spanish to communicate with newcomer students. Like, God put that in my heart when I felt frustration about needing to, you know, instruct children on something, and I didn't have the capability to do it. And so God was like, well, if you want to demonstrate for these children, you know, the joy of learning, which is part of what I do, how about you embrace some joy in learning yourself, woman? And that's really what it brought me to. Can we find new joy in living and trying to do something about all these things? Do I feel joyful about the newly assigned roles? You know, joy being found in being with my mom. Yes, like knowing that this is a gift. And one day I'm going to long to have this precious time back. I know it, because I've lost family members, you know. Can I love her and feel loved by her, even though sometimes she repeats herself? Can I hear her stories with a fresh ear? Can I look for something new, a new nugget in what my mother's trying to tell me? Can I learn something from her 88 years of wisdom, you know? Do I have joy in learning a language and how that has changed the way that I interact, and not just with my students but with their parents and actually with other kids in the building? That very often we have new kids that walk into the building and they look, you know, they're shell-shocked, and I can actually greet them in the hall and help them find their way. And I've fallen in love with learning a new language. Like, I know that that is a direct result of the program rather than me grumbling and complaining that I don't get enough support in my classroom. You know, I can't fix, manage, and control. That is something I'm actually powerless to, what other people do. But I'm not powerless over my own ability to sort of embrace a spirit of learning and growth, which I got from this program. You know, I also have today incredible joy in my marriage. Yesterday was my husband and I, we celebrated our 27th wedding anniversary. That I've been in relationship with this man for 30 years, and we've gone through many things together. And today, you know, we're getting more and more opportunities to have fun together. We have a married daughter now, a teenage son, and we're finding ourselves able to get out and have fun together in a new way. And we, you know, we see concerts together and local bands play, and we dance and we hike and we socialize and we have joy. And I meet my responsibilities with Overeaters Anonymous with enthusiasm. Thank you, God. My husband loves and supports this program very much. But also when I'm out with my husband, I turn the ringer off my phone because I have a responsibility to protect my marriage. And I feel the same way when I'm transporting my kids around, you know, if I'm driving my son around. That time is very precious. You know, more and more he's driving himself places, and more, you know, we're kind of doing, we're this time together in one car is coming to an end. And when I'm driving my son someplace, my phone is off because I want to be present with him. You know, the AA 12 and 12 also talks about our basic troubles, that they're the same as everyone else's. But when an honest effort, this is on page 114, when an honest effort is made to practice these principles in all our affairs, well-grounded AAs seem to have the ability, by God's grace, to take these troubles in stride and turn them into demonstrations of faith. So my troubles are the same as everyone's, like all the rest of the world. I've got trouble, like everybody else. And I take them in stride, which is very different, I would say, from many others. You know, this is not I work my program, but rather I integrate it so that I have the ability to take my problems and troubles, and what happens when I do is that I get to be the demonstration of faith. And that's a really powerful thing to offer, not just to people in a fellowship, but people in the world, like people in my life, in my community, my whole life, wherever I go, in my family. You know, I actually had a coworker tell me this week that I shine. She's like, I don't know, you just shine. And that just fills me, like, I feel so happy that I'm seen as someone who's shiny. I feel shiny, you know. And so I'm going to give, like, two quick examples, because I know I want to get to Jason as well, of actually three examples that happened recently and how living these steps, which is my program in action, that enables me to have a relationship with power that will solve my problems. That's my only solution. And it's essential that I practice these principles in all my affairs. So here's a basic problem. I had a roach infestation in my classroom. Like, I had seen more cockroaches crawl out of, I'm sorry if I hope I'm not skeeving anybody out at, you know, 9 o'clock Eastern time warning, but it came out of a child's folder and book bag, more cockroaches than I've ever seen, and I freaked out. I went like, oh my God. I totally, you know, reacted. And my class, you know, in turn, we had to, you know, we evacuated our room for the day. We had to teach on stage. You know, a whole thing was done. And then my prayer and meditation hit me hard that night when I went and reviewed my day, because I had a lot of resentments, right, and a lot of fear. And then I realized my selfishness, and I had remorse, regret, and I felt horrible because I realized that I reacted so over the top and how that must have made that particular child feel. Like, it broke my heart. When I sat in prayer, I started crying. I felt so bad. How did I do this to this child? And the humiliation he might have felt, or just the shame in front of his teacher, who I know he loves me, and how it must have been really painful for him to go home because he lives with those roaches. And so I made amends to him. I made amends to the class. I said my reaction was really severe and over the top. And I shared this, you know, I shared this story with my son, who, by the way, my son is an insect lover. He's going to study entomology when he goes to college because he loves bugs. And he said, Mom, you, of all people, who love God so much, you should know that God loves the insect because he's created millions of more beetles than any, you know, than any other species, far more beetles than humans, and a cockroach is a beetle. So, you know, the practical application of this program taught me to go back, make amends, restitution. And I hugged that kid close and tight. You know, the other area was I had a situation where I overheard my brother-in-law And I realized, you know, first of all, I overheard him talk to me. He's frustrated. My mother lives with him and my sister. And what can I do? I've got to pitch in more. I've got to get my mother out of their house more. Because if I overheard him talking about me, how about the fact that he has no privacy, that his privacy is impacted by where my mother lives there? What can I do? What can I do to be useful, God? And God put it on my heart. Like, say nothing. He doesn't need to know that you overheard him. Your sister doesn't need to know that you overheard them. They're entitled to their privacy, you know, and now get your mother out of that house more and give them some space. You know, another example is a brother of mine who I feel really hasn't made much time for me, you know, in our adult life, and we were extraordinarily close. And what God put on my heart was, I am in charge of who comes on your stage and who exits your stage. And just because someone had a very central role on that stage at one time does not diminish the importance that those scenes had on your life. But let that scene maybe come to an end for now, because there's only so many players I can put on your stage at one time. And girl, your stage is full. It's too full for those that you, like your mother's right here. You have time. Give your mother the time, you know. And so, you know, in There's a Solution, I'm going to end with this. On page 27, it says, the ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding forces of the lives of these men, are suddenly cast to one side, and a whole new conception, a set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. What does that mean to me? It means that I've got new ideas, I've got new emotions, and I've got new attitudes, and they guide my life. And, you know, so I also think that when those things take plant inside of me, take root inside me, the things that I have to do become the very things that I want to do. And so it's not really a challenge to live, embody, and integrate the steps. My program is my design for living. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Jason. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Melissa. I had to remind myself we weren't just talking and spending some time on the phone, just the two of us, as you were talking and I was listening. So thank you for that. So I'm going to talk about some quotes from the Big Book and just kind of point out some things that kind of speak to our theme. I'm going to kind of share a few reflections, and then I think the thing that's most meaningful to me is some practical, concrete stories. I'm going to try to do this in 20 to 25 minutes here. So some of the quotes from the Big Book, and I think Vision for You is a strong meeting because we insist upon sharing from the literature and going back to the literature and keeping our messages and are sharing consistent with that. So I want to go into the Big Book. On page 102, it's in the chapter Working with Others. They're talking here about should we go to a place where they're serving alcohol and schemes that serve to shield the alcoholic from alcohol. And Bill says in this part of the book, he says, make sure you're on solid spiritual ground. Do not think of what you will get out of the occasion. Think of what you can bring to it. He says, if this is a happy occasion, try to increase the pleasure of those there. If it is business, go and attend to your business enthusiastically. If you are with a person who wants to go eat at a bar, by all means, go along. While you were drinking, you were withdrawing from life little by little. Now you're getting back into the social life of this world. Do not start to withdraw again just because your friend drinks liquor. Your job is to now be at a place where you may be of maximum helpfulness to others. So never hesitate to go anywhere if you could be helpful. You should not hesitate to visit the most sordid spot on earth on such an errand. Keep on the firing line of life with those motives, and God will keep you unharmed. So for me, these are things that I try to take into every part of my life. And you'll see when I start to share my stories how these things are put into practice on a concrete way. But I think, like, this, for me, this is when Bill's talking about this. He's talking about the attitude we should have, the perspective we should have going into anything. On page 83, it says the spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. A little later on, it says the family may not want to live on a spiritual basis, but do not try to convince them. Our behavior will convince them more than our words. And I don't think they mean our behavior in an OA meeting. I don't think they mean our behavior while we're doing a step 10 inventory. I think they literally mean our behavior at every step of the every part of the day throughout our entire life. Another quote that I really love, and sorry, I forgot to put the page number down, is every day is a day where we must carry the vision of God's will into all our activities. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. And then I'm going to give you a few more. And as we go through the day, we pause when agitated or doubtful. We ask for the right thought or action. So in these last two quotes, we're talking about every single activity, every part of our day. We're bringing the vision of God's will in. If we're agitated or doubtful, we're pausing, asking for the right thought or action. And our step 10 instructions say we have entered the world of the Spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for a lifetime. So we see this framework, and we see this quote, these quotes in the big book about how our attitude is to be one of service, how we're supposed to go day by day carrying a vision of God's will for us into every aspect, how if we're agitated, we pause, we ask for the right thought or action. So I just want to share a few thoughts about this. Like, I'm very much a perfectionist. I love to kind of tick off boxes. I like to say, you know, I did this, I did that. You know, and I hear people sometimes, and I would get really engaged in this, oh, you know, every day I need to do a little bit more for my program, and my disease is doing push-ups. And I'm very literal, like, I'm very, like, perfectionistic. So I'm like, well, if I did two program calls yesterday, I should do three today. And if I do three today, I should do four tomorrow. And if I manage to get in, you know, two 10 steps today, I should do three tomorrow. But I design for a living for me because, again, I'm very perfectionistic. I'm very literal. And this is, you know, it's kind of more of a thought experiment. Like, we literally can't do that because we'd spend our entire life doing program eventually. And I've also had this really funny realization when I talk to people and I'm, say, you know, thinking about how they get all this stuff done. I'd like to ask a question that's a really key question here. Are you retired? Because I've had people say, well, yes, I am. And I'm like, well, how do I take your advice and still work my full-time job and still, you know, have a wife and we got a baby on the way? And they kind of laugh with me. And I realize I was comparing apples to oranges, not apples to apples. And we also had this question about living a life that's like happy, joyous, and free. I remember being on the line, the Vision for You meeting, during the second hour one time, and somebody asked this question, you know, I'm not happy, you know, I'm not feeling joy. And so people got on and they talked about, well, do more inventory and take more responsees and, you know, reflect on this, and is your first step in line? And part of me just wondered, you know, what if that person sat down and just asked God guidance of what would make them truly happy and what would really bring them the most joy in life? Because I know for me, you know, doing a lot more inventory and taking on 14 more sponsees, you know, would be probably joyful and meaningful. But some of the things that bring me the most joy in my life are athletic pursuits. You know, playing ice hockey is one of my favorite things to do, you know, exercising, you know, spending time with my wife. And I think I tend to think in this black and white thinking. So, you know, program is the first and most important thing. And for me, I think in extremes. So, like, I spent time in my early program where it was just all about program. Everything is this and, you know, every waking minute. And again, I'm a person of extremes. I have these, like, heat warmers in my car. They're either on zero, as in off, or five, high. Like, I've gone from, like, heat in my car to being like, oh, my gosh, I'm too hot, and I turned on the AC, like, boom, 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 back and forth. So for me, part of my maturity and recovery is an integrated vision. You know, do I do more 10 steps? Do I do more, you know, sponsorship? Do I do more involvement in the program? Or do I go out and, you know, I just started playing soccer. First game tonight. Like, I love sports. I love playing soccer. I love playing hockey. I'm playing soccer tonight. Did I take on a new sponsee recently? Yes. but the arbiter of that is my conscience, asking God for an intuitive thought or a decision. How do I balance, you know, program and living? And what we also see is there's very little distinction in my mind between an explicit program and me living my life, you know. And if you looked at my life from the outside, you say, oh, yeah, Jason went to that meeting, and it looks like Jason is praying and meditating, and it looks like Jason went to work. But for me, there's a continuous thread between all of those things. So I wanted to get into some kind of, like, nuts and bolts, like some stories. Like, I think this kind of gives a sense of, like, who I am and how I think of program in this integrated way. So like I said, I love hockey, and I had a big hockey tournament yesterday morning. I thought I woke up in time to meditate and pray and do my practices, but it turns out I didn't. So I started waking up and getting busy, and I was like, I'm running out of time. And so I got in the car, and I was feeling this sense of shame, guilt, resentment, a little bit of fear. Oh, I didn't meditate. Oh, my gosh, what's going on? So I reached out for a 10-step, and thankfully I got a hold of somebody pretty quickly, and I talked that through, and I prayed about it. I asked God, please remove, you know, these defects of character, you know, this sense of, like, shame and judgment and, you know, this lack of integrity. I made this mistake. I didn't wake up early enough. And then this shift happened, and it's like, Jason, look it. You know, this tournament is for my company. We're raising money for people with special needs. I'm like, I'm a team captain. I'm supposed to go there and make sure everybody signs their waiver, make sure everybody gets their free T-shirt. I need to make sure everybody knows what's happening. I need to make the lines. And I'm like, I am going there to be of service. Like, this is program. And this is exactly, it was funny because I was thinking, like, ah, I didn't do my program. I'm going to have a bad day. I'm not going to get to do program stuff. And, of course, the point of this talk is program and life are not so separate. And they're not as separate as we think they are. And I realized I had some time in the car to pray, and I had thought of that before, just kind of talking to God out loud, like, you know, God was a good friend of mine, and the person suggested that, and I said, yeah, that makes sense. So I hung up the phone, and I just started talking to God, and I started praying, and I started having these deep feelings. I prayed for my wife and our new baby and to be of service to them, and I just started feeling flooded with, like, emotion and just this deep sense of gratitude, and just had these tears to my eye, come to my eyes, and you know, and there I was having this deep spiritual experience, this sense of deep appreciation, these tears coming down my face, and then I kind of get through a little bit of that emotion, and I keep praying, and then I come back again, and I'm like, I'm going to a hockey game here with tears in my eyes, and people are going to wonder what's going on with me, but again, it's all integrated. Another thing to talk about is the grocery store. I started this habit a while back. When I go to the grocery store, I always try to take a cart either from the corral or find a cart that's loose and I take it in. Now, I think of this as in the spirit of making amends. You know, I used to live a life selfish and self-centered, focused on me, myself, my feelings, getting what I want, avoiding things I didn't want, a very, very selfish. It wasn't because I was a notorious cart bandit who always left my cart out of the corral, but I always saw this as some way to contribute to something larger, to be helpful, to be of service. So I always bring carts in, and it's really funny, and I sometimes, too, I start arranging the cart corral. I'm like, oh, the little ones go here, the big ones go here. I was doing that one day, and this woman just parked, and she looks over at me. She's like, you're a really nice guy. I'm like, oh, okay. but she saw something. She reflected something back to me, a person who's giving consideration, a person who's contributing to life, not being a taker, not being inconsiderate. And I'll go into the grocery store, and I'll start feeling anxious because it's the Sunday rush, and I'll start to feel like, I wish these darn people would get out of my way. Now, can I do a 10-step on that? Yes. Do I have time to do a 10-step on that in the moment? Not necessarily, but I start to notice, hey, I'm being really selfish right now. I need to slow down. These people are here to shop too. So then I have to start slowing down. I have to start taking my time because one of my character defects is rushing around and trying to do too much, being driven by fear, focused on productivity. And another quick grocery store. And the grocery store is a funny thing to me because We think of spiritual experiences. We think of meditating, at an ashram or, going to church or going to some sort of spiritual place, going to a mountaintop and seeing the vast expanse of wilderness, But after that, what about the laundry? Or like Melissa said, mowing the lawn. What about going to the grocery store? Is there a spiritual experience to be had there? And so recently I was in the grocery store and here's frozen broccoli. Grab a bunch of bags. It's organic. I'm like, I'm not attached to organic or conventional, but I see it. I grab it. And then I go down to another little section and I see broccoli. Oh, it's half the price of the organic and it's in bigger bags. I love buying in bulk. And immediately my thinking goes to, why don't they put all the broccoli together? That way we can make an informed decision. This is stupid. I'm going to just throw this organic broccoli right back here with this conventional broccoli, take the broccoli that I want. They can sort it out. It's their problem. And then I just have to laugh at myself. I'm like, oh, you're holding a grudge now. You think you know how this whole grocery store should be arranged. I'm like, you are not going to leave this for them to figure out. And I go and I take the organic broccoli back and I put it back. So as I'm saying this, apparently I work for grocery stores in my spare time as I'm taking care of their carts and their inventory. But for me, it's just a part of, it started to become a part of who I am. That thinking of, oh, here's a resentment, right? I'm not going to sit there and, do a 10th step because, a formal 10th step because I'm resentful that I, took the wrong broccoli and it's not all together and I'm confused. I fix that immediately. Another barometer of my spiritual fitness is my driving behavior. We have this quote in the Big Book that, we're not cured, and what we really have is a daily reprieve based upon our spiritual fitness. And I think one of the good barometers of my spiritual fitness is if I'm driving the speed limit. And I've done a lot of 10 steps in my car, and again, I have a chronic thing where I'm fearful and I'm moving too fast. When I pause, when agitated or doubtful, I get the thought a lot to slow down. Slow down, Jason, you're moving too fast. And I'll get that thought, it seems counterintuitive, but it's a sort of a spiritual principle. I have a lot to do, I need to go faster. I'll say, God, please remove this. God, please help me. I might take a deep breath and I might pause. And I'll get the intuitive thought, just slow down, Jason. You're doing too much. Now, and I'll do a lot of 10 steps while I'm driving. I'll talk to people, and it's funny because when it comes to a corrective measure, okay, God, remove these defects of character. And sometimes those 10 steps are about the person who cut in front of me and they didn't signal. Sometimes they're about, stuff at work or different things. A lot of the times I say my corrective measure is to put on cruise control and stay in the right lane and not pass people. And again, it's so practical. That's me living a spiritual life in the right lane, in cruise control. I want to talk about my work for a little bit. Work is a really, really important place for me to practice spiritual principles. I'm lucky that I'm in a company that works with people with special needs and individuals with disabilities. Our mission statement is to help others meet their potential and grow. I work with students who are emotionally, behaviorally disabled. Come to work and I try to be of service. I try to be helpful. I try to see the bigger picture. I try not to give my administrator a hard time. And we have a philosophy of servant leadership. We try to go there to be of service. We lead by being of service. And my boss started to say things to me like, I think you could be a leader. I think I see some leadership potential in you. And at first I'm like, get the heck out of here. I didn't say that out loud. I said that in my mind. But she said she ended up giving me a new job with some more responsibilities and some leadership. So I'm in the business of helping these new students, not so much with autism, but emotional behavioral disturbances. I had this experience the other day talking to one of my parents, and I had learned with this student that she had been thrown out of different schools. They didn't really give her a chance. She really felt this sense of rejection. And I started telling that mom, we're not going to give up on your daughter. I said, we're going to keep her. She has so much potential. I said, we're seeing this out of her. We're seeing that out of her. And I just started getting to tears, and those tears are coming back now because the very point of my job is to care about this young lady, this young woman, and this very point of this job is to serve this family And it's very point of this job is to see the potential in that young woman and nurture her potential. And if I wouldn't have stopped talking to that mom, I would have been literally in tears, and I had to just kind of stop when my eyes were tearing up and getting red. But for me, that's like a small spiritual experience. That's me being of service. That's me not thinking about my ego. That's me not thinking about, you know, how difficult it is to serve the student. That's me speaking truth and speaking a commitment to that mom and saying, we're here to help. I was on my way, so that's one story. I was on my way to work also, and I started talking about feeling a little stuck in my spiritual life. I was kind of in some self-pity. I wasn't really feeling the flow of things. And the person said, and this was my friend Leslie, who I just talked to this morning. She said in her beautiful southern accent, it sounds like you're living in the problem and not the solution. And I was like, yep. And I said, you know, that really applies to my work life too. I'd been going to work feeling discouraged, overwhelmed, not really showing up for my staff. And then I'm like, you know, I need to apply that same principle to my work life. And I came into work that day. I said, let's not focus on the problems. Let's focus on the solution. Who needs help in this school? Which staff members are struggling? And I'm like an administrator, so I have to think about the whole school, every staff, every student. Where do they need help? Where do they need support? So I get to bounce around trying to help people. That's like my day. That's my day job all day, every day. Who do I help? Students and staff. It's very cool. I had another student with, we had an issue and he was having a crisis and I had to go physically hands-on with that student. It was a rainy day. He went outside of the school. I had to go physical hands-on. We do these restraints just to maintain safety. But in the process of that, his clothing got all muddy and he ruined his clothing. And that was just extremely difficult for him. He was really upset. And when I thought back on that experience, I was like, I don't know if I needed to be that physical with him. And I know he's really mad at me. And the next day he came into school. I had to talk to him. I said, are we good? And we weren't good, right? He could tell his body language. He shook his head no. I said, I'm sorry, your clothes got ruined. I said, in the future, if I have to go hands-on with you, I'll try to do it like this. I said, do you understand what happened yesterday? Do you understand I'm not mad at you? Do you understand I'm not punishing you? Do you understand I'm trying to keep everybody safe? Do you understand the decision that I made? I'm really sorry about your clothing. I said, how can we do this better next time? To me, that's making amends. This isn't, you know, it's not formal, writing a letter, but I need to reestablish trust with that student. And for me, this is just a part of how I do business. One last work story, and I'll get to kind of home and some things at the gym, and I'll wrap up here. I want to tell you about one of my interesting, intense prayer times and spiritual work times. I had a student refusing to go into the school. Now, he's sitting on the ground in the parking lot saying, I'm not going back in that school. And I was sitting there with him. Now, he really wasn't following my script, right? He was refusing to go in the school. And my brain was resentful. It was going this, that, and the other thing, son of a gun, you know, some other choice words in my mind. I can tell you I prayed more intensely in that parking lot than I did that morning in my morning prayer. And I prayed through that whole experience because I was struggling. And I had to make right decisions with that kid. And I had to give him space and time and grace. And I had to, you know, give him, I had to work with that student. So that was pausing when agitated and doubtful. That was, you know, praying in my brain, doing in my mind, doing 10 steps in the moment. And my spiritual life really goes into my home as well. I have like my relationship to doing dishes. You know, Melissa said, you know, mowing the lawn. For me, dishes is my big one. My sort of spiritual principle is do all the dishes I make every day, you know, do all the dishes I dirty every day, clean them, put them away. But I noticed maybe my housemates and my wife aren't always on track with that. And those are times for me to pause and I say, you know, well, who do I want to be? Do I want to be somebody who complains, who constantly is asking others to do their dishes? Most of the time, I tend to just do the dishes. Sometimes I don't have it in me. I just do my dishes. but I always try to put away some dishes. The other day I was struggling and I said, honey, what do you think about doing the dishes tonight? I think I did mine. I think I'm done. And she agreed. And I started to ask these questions, you know, how do I support her? And I started thinking about, well, maybe I'll put the dogs away because that's what she usually does when she's doing the dishes. And I said, why don't I rub her shoulders while she's doing the dishes? And she says, oh, this is nice. I appreciate this. And then I said, can I do my nightly review? And I said, I'll just do it verbally. And she said, sure. So, you know, what I think how I would have handled that in the past is I might have got resentful. I might have been mad. This is pre-recovery. I might have been mad at a partner for not doing dishes. I might have, you know, given them a guilt trip. I certainly wouldn't have asked, like, how can I be helpful to this person? It probably would have been a little different than that. Another way that I think I try to live spiritual principles in the gym, right? It's very important to me. I do group fitness training, and sometimes I don't want to go, and I've done 10 sets on this, and a lot of the things that gets me over the hump when I don't want to go is I'm there to encourage others. We work out in a group. My philosophy is I come on time, I stay to the end, I pick up everything that we use. We bring out weights, we bring out different materials, different equipment. I put everything away. I don't leave until everything's away. My other goal in that is to encourage people. You know, we can be cheerleaders for others. Sometimes this is awkward. I'm like, I'm not a natural cheerleader. A lot of times I just do it in my head, and then I know when it comes out, it doesn't sound so weird. I also try to learn everybody's names. You know, there's certain people at the gym, like, wow, they're super fit. They're a rock star. They're like, you know, and then there's people who, you know, are off to the side, you know. I try to learn those people's names. I try to make them feel welcome. When new people come, hey, are you new to the gym? Are you doing okay? You're going to get through this. Here's some advice. This is what I did when I first came. And then the owner of the gym, he just came to me one day. He says, can I talk to you? He's like, there's something different about you. You have a different mentality. You have a different mindset. And he started telling me about some of the problems he's having. And I ended up helping him. You know, I started being a part of the solution to some of his problems. I started teaching a class for him because I'm a teacher. I love to teach, and I've done all the moves, and I'm not technically a personal trainer. And then, you know, spiritual experiences, minor spiritual experiences seem to come to me all the time. Sometimes when I'm at that gym, you know, we work so hard, it's physically so demanding, and I have these weird breakdowns of my ego because you're just, you know, in pain, laying on the floor. And a lot of times I've thought of my dad, you know, my dad dying of cancer and thinking about the pain he must have experienced and everything through his body, and I just have had these deep moments of empathy. So again, I'm in a high-intensity interval training fitness class, almost weeping because thinking of my dad and what he must have gone through with the cancer as he was dying and, you know, the quality of his life and the pain that he felt and, you know, remembering my dad, feeling close to my dad. Again, it's not a church. It's not in a journaling session. It's not in a prayer meditation session. I'm going to wrap up a little bit. I hope these stories are amusing to you and interesting. I hope people are getting a lot out of them. You know, we really wanted to paint a vision today of a life that's integrated, the 12 steps, you know, and a way of living, a program of living that's very integrated, that these principles, that thoughts of service and kindness towards other, consideration towards other, you know, go with you. And if you've had this spiritual awakening, I want to encourage you towards a greater integration, towards a vision recovery that's very compelling to a newcomer. And that's just bigger than just inventory and meetings and phone calls and 10 steps and da-da-da. But we want to paint a vision of life and program and recovery that's, for me, that's one of deep joy and integration. You know, Bill says in the 12 and 12, I believe, he says, our primary responsibility to the newcomer is an accurate depiction of the steps and the program and recovery. And I think talking about our lives in general, how we've changed, how everything feels different to us is very important. So I'm just gonna pound this point home with the final quote. The great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude towards life, towards our fellows and towards God's universe. And with that, I'll pass.
Thank you very, very much. You know, I was just thinking about how thorough that was, and it is our way of life as we integrate all of these things into that. And Bill Wilson was certainly saying that it has its practical application to everyone, this way of living, because it's goodness and it's joy and it's freedom and it's thinking of others and being of service to folks and stepping outside of ourselves. And you two described that just beautifully today, absolutely beautifully today. You know, it took away some of the, in my mind, some of the worry and the panic, you know, that sometimes we might have of surrendering our life to a program of recovery. It's been the best thing ever. It has been the best thing ever, and it continues to do so and be so, and that was proven in your stories today. Thank you. Thank you very much. We're going to get Jason and Melissa's contact information at the conclusion of the meeting today after the recording has stopped. So stay around for that. You may want to be in contact with them today or at another time sometime again, so you'll have that number. The share ID number, so you can have this again, to listen to it again. The details are so, so profound. 313. Now, wait a minute. I don't think that's quite right. Yeah, it is 21,313, 21313, 21,313. So here we go, Jason and Melissa, the lines are now open for questions for you. Hey, folks, if you have a question for either one, please unmute your phone by pressing star 1 on your phone keypad. Offer your first name, the first letter of your last name, and your state. And then immediately upon asking your question, please press star 1 again to mute your line. Who would like to ask a question this morning? Give them to me slowly, folks.
Hi, Sonia S. from Philadelphia.
Sonia S.
Susan P. from Georgia.
Susan
Caroline
P.
from
Georgia.
Iowa.
Georgia. Caroline
Pete Brown from Pennsylvania.
I got Pete G. from Pennsylvania. I actually got you first, Pete, actually, and I didn't mention it. And then I have a Rosalyn. And what was your the first initial of your last name?
P.
P like Charlie?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. Anyone else this morning?
Jennifer, South Carolina.
Somebody from South Carolina. What was that?
Jennifer C.
Jennifer C. Okay. Let's go with that line
and
up
then
here
you get
see
me.
What we come up with. And
okay.
I'm sorry. Who was that?
Oh, this is Caroline from Iowa. I just making sure you got me.
Yes, I did. I did. You're kind of midway
thank
in
you.
That lineup there, so hang tight. You bet.
Yeah.
Okay,
thanks.
This is what I have. Pete B., Sonia S., Susan P., Caroline L., Rosalyn C., and Jennifer C. First up with a question, Pete B. from Pennsylvania. Good morning. Going to have to press star 1, I think, Pete.
Sorry about that. Thank you, Melanie, for your service. I really appreciate it. And thank you both for your presentation. It was deep and heavy and really, really liked it. So I'm just interested in your perspective here, because you both talked about, you know, considering things that you do as an amends in some way, shape, or form. In the big book, in step 8, it says we made a list of people we have harmed and became willing to make amends. And in step 9, it says that we make direct amends. And in step 10, it says if we've harmed anybody, we make amends. Yet in step 11, when we do our daily review, it talks about an apology. So I'm curious in your perspective, why do they use different words? Three instances they use amends and one they use apology. And if there's a difference between an apology and an amends. And with that, I'll pass.
Thanks. I'm pretty motivated to answer that. So I'll jump in, Melissa, and see if you have anything to add. Thanks, Pete. Bill is notorious or sort of known in my mind for using lots of different words for the same thing. So with the word amends, he'll talk about restitutions. Restitution takes various forms. We clean up the past and so on and so forth. I don't know why Bill did that, but I wouldn't think too deeply about it. And I think the spirit of the law and the spirit of the program says, we clean up, we clean up, we clean up. Now, sometimes an apology is appropriate, but sometimes a restitution is appropriate. If I stole $10 from you, Pete, and said, I'm sorry, we'd say, give me the $10. If I said something unkind to you, I might say, I'm sorry. I would like to say something kind in exchange. I'd like to say I'm sorry. So I think sometimes the apology is appropriate. Sometimes the restitution is appropriate. I don't necessarily like the concept of living amends because we, you know, it's not in the big book, but we do actually become willing to change our behavior and patterns of behavior. And there are things we sort of do differently in the future, but we should always try to clean them up directly if we can. Melissa, do you have anything to add?
I mean, I think that was pretty thorough, although I would just say I do, sometimes it's an apology. I mean, sometimes that's the appropriate thing, but I would say an apology that doesn't get followed through by a change is just an empty mumbling, I'm sorry. Like, there's nothing... so what, you're sorry, like Jason said, like, where's my money? But I also do think that there is room for a living amend. I know for myself, one of the amends that I made with my husband, you know, was I did apologize to him for being very critical about the way that the things that he was taking care of in the house and my lack thereof, and that the way that I live, an amend means to change. It means to fix, it means to change, it means to alter. And so part of it for me was like, okay, you know, rather than just grumbling and complaining on a regular basis, how are you helping? Like myself, what am I doing to participate? And I hope that's helpful. I'll pass. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Pete B., for the question today. That's Pete B. from Pennsylvania. Thank you. Next up is Sonia S. And then following Sonia will be Susan P. So get ready for your question, Susan. Hi, Sonia.
Hi, good morning. Thank you, everyone, for sharing. This was excellent, excellent. I'm always curious to know about other fellows' quiet time, like when they do it and what it looks like. And anybody can answer that question. I'm always interested in that because that's something that can be a challenge for me. And I've heard like people suggest first thing in the morning, but I was just curious what your point of view is on that. Thank you.
Go ahead, Melissa.
I
did a whole special edition on daily routines and practical spirituality, which I would refer you to. But Melissa, why don't you go ahead and take that one?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is extremely important. I think part of my step one understanding means that I am without power, that I must find a power, a relationship with a power greater than myself that can restore me because I'm at the end of me. And so my personal, you know, practice is, I do it in the morning, whether it's first thing in the morning. It takes me a minute to wake up, to come to me. But after I shower, I need to, you know, generally take a shower. I come, I've made a sacred space for myself in my home, I have a spot. You know, there are many, we are really encouraged to explore this. And I think it's great to ask lots of people what they do. But if I'm looking, you know, basically I'm looking to form a relationship with power. And so I cannot have a relationship with anything if I don't give it time and I don't give it space and I don't do it in a way, I must do it in a way that I actually begin to enjoy. Like any relationship, if it's only obligatory, if I only get together with my husband out of a sense of obligation and duty, there's not much of a relationship here. But if we look to do things that we love and spend time together and enjoy, and I would say the same thing with my higher power, with God. So there are loads of things you can do to sort of cultivate that and create that sacred space and time. And, you know, pick up the AA 12 and 12 and read step 11, and it gives you a lot of great practical advice and places where you can do it and ways that you can. And hope that helps. Thanks. Pass.
Thank you very much for the question, Sonia S. from Pennsylvania. Susan P., your question is up now, and then Caroline will follow you. Good morning, Susan.
Can I be heard?
Loud and clear. You just jump right in. We'll let you know.
Yeah, this refers to, thank you, Melissa and Jason, for, you know, really helpful shares. This refers to something that Melissa said You were talking about your relationship with your mother and how she repeats herself, but you treat it compassionately. Well, unfortunately, I lived with my mother between 2010 and 2017 when she passed away at age 92. And I wasn't in recovery, but I did my best to be loving and helpful. But I finally got impatient with her repeating herself, and I mentioned it to her, you know, why do you repeat yourself so much? And it really hurt her. And she says, who else do I have to talk to? And after that, you know, she just closed herself up, and she's passed away. And I have, you know, I know the big book says, you know, we shouldn't sink into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, but it really kicks my butt, because how do you make an amends to someone who's passed? That's my question.
I'm sorry. I'm offering you my condolences. My dad is no longer here, and so I have things that I too, you know, wish I did different, and I've lost many people along the way. I think, you know, I believe in a relationship with God first and foremost. You know, like, I bring my things that I have deep regret, things that I feel really bad. Sometimes things we can't go back in time and do anything different about. But I ask God's forgiveness. You know, I ask God to forgive me, and I believe God knows my heart. And I would ask you, like, do you believe that you're forgiven by God? Do you believe God forgives you? Not, you know, and if that be the case, then who are you to withhold forgiveness for yourself? I mean, how do you make amends? I think you really can't. You can write, you know, there's loads of things you can do. People talk about writing a letter and bringing it to, you know, the graveside. You know, you can't go back in time. The best I can do is take this information and move forward, right? That's really it. And bring it to God. Ask God. God will show you what to do. I'll pass.
Thank you very much, Susan P. from Georgia, for your question. Caroline L., you're up next with a question, followed by Rosalyn. Star one, Caroline.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. I just want to say thank you so much for both of your shares. Amazing. God knew I needed to be on this meeting. It's been a while. But anyway, my question is, I recently added a second program, and I was wondering, do you have multiple programs? And if so, how do you integrate everything in your life, still be present for all of your recovery commitments and also your family or just whatever is going on in your life? Because I would love some experience, strength, and hope in that, and how you handle all of that or how you surrender all of it. But it's put on your oxygen mask before you put on others. But with multiple programs, I have two young kids, and so a 1 and 3 year old. So I was just curious if you have any experience with that. And what you would have to say.
I don't. Melissa, do you have any experience with that? And I'm not sure what the traditions say about singularness of purpose and talking about other programs. But Melissa, do you have any thoughts?
I mean, I don't have another program. So that specific issue, it's not something I can answer. But I will say that everybody has, like, extraordinarily full lives with, like, if I listed all my obligations and all the things that I really believe that, you know, are my responsibilities on a daily basis, you'd say, holy crap, who could possibly do all of this? And I always urge people, first of all, hopefully you have a sponsor in both these programs. And I would say these are really good questions to ask your sponsors and have them help you, you know, create a way that you can, you know, where, I don't know where you are in the step work for either of these programs, if you have longer recovery in one based than the other. And so those are questions that I would say you could discuss with your your sponsors. But the other thing is, with all my list of responsibilities and all the things that I need to do, you know, we're given very clear direction that in the morning when we pray, we ask God to direct our thinking, that we work with God to make an outline of our plan for the day, that we ask God to sort of guide us in the things that need to be done first. What's first and foremost for my day? What are the things that I must attend to, and what are the things that I could, you know, possibly not do today? I hope that's helpful, Carolyn.
Thank you very much for the question. And just to, you know, give a little backstory, that we do practice singleness of purpose here in terms of what Jason was mentioning about traditions. However, we are very clear that our credits don't transfer, and many of us have, you know, more than one program that we follow. So, Carolyn, I would just recommend that maybe you check our membership list and give me a call, and I can give some help and direction and support with that. But the information that Melissa gave, I think, is very, very valuable as well. But I just want to mention the singleness of purpose for anybody else that might have the same question and idea about things. Next up for questions, Rosalind C. from Ohio, followed by Jennifer C. Hi, Rosalind.
Hi, Melanie. Thank you for allowing me to be on the call and share this morning. But I'll thank God most of all for the young lady said before, it was meant for me to be on this call this morning. The questions I had have been answered prior to. So I just want to say that I have gratitude for the both of you. The both of your shares were different, but had the same profound effect. Living according to the spiritual principle and find joy. I mean, you guys are, you know, just epitomes of what the recovery looks like. And you've definitely given me more insight and depth into how that work walks out in life and daily living. So, again, thank you both. And I really appreciate hearing your shares this morning. Thank you, Melanie. And I pass.
So I think that we didn't have a question within that one. So thank you, Rosalind C. And let's make sure that we formulate our time with a question that would be most effective in our meeting today. But thank you, Rosalind. Jennifer C., your question this morning. Jennifer, are we able to hear you? Sometimes the function of star one doesn't allow us to be heard.
Good morning. Can you hear me now?
I can. There you go.
Yay.
Good perseverance. There you go. Your question, please.
Thank you. And Melissa and Jason, thank you both so much. Thank you so much for that. And just that reminder that this is all about how we live. Jason, as you talk about the 10th step, I noticed that you do mention that there are times when sharing it with another person is necessary and appropriate, but there seems to be a lot of times when you believe that you can have a healthy completion of the 10th step without calling another fellow. And can you just clarify that for me and just speak to the fact that, you know, the idea sometimes can be that it always has to be shared or that it's incomplete. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you. As much as I want to formulate specific sort of rules or clarity about when it's supposed to be shared, when it's not supposed to be shared, I've never been able to come up with the clarity. So I think we always have a good answer to questions that we're struggling with in recovery is, you know, we look for intuitive thoughts and guidance. God, do I need to share this with another person? God, do I need to get something off my chest? A lot of it's just practical, you know. I'm sitting in the parking lot with a student. It's not appropriate to be on my phone. You know, dealing with a crisis situation. You know, my wife broke her wrist a couple weeks ago. We're driving to the hospital. You know, she really needs a lot of help. I need to be absolutely focused there with her. It's just not appropriate. And if I pray and ask God, what do I need? You know, it's not to walk away and do a 10-step. It's to be absolutely present with her in that moment, you know, in the emergency room. There are times when I'll have a gap in my day and I'll be like, I want to get connected. And I'll be like, do I have a 10-step? And I'm drudging for 10-steps. Like, do I have any fears going on? Like, I'm looking for one because I'm a very structure-oriented person, and it's much easier for me to call Melissa up and say, hey, Melissa, I have a 10-step. Will you take this? Versus, hey, Melissa, I just need some connection, and here's an open space, and let's see what happens. The latter is very nerve-wracking for me, and it just doesn't fit my personality as well. So I sometimes dredge for 10 steps. Like, I probably could do one. I have a very, very consistent 10-step buddy who, when she calls, she'll say, do you have any 10 steps? And we're very focused on that. And we both, I think, thrive from that structure. And I've started many a 10-step saying with, yeah, I could do one. And it's not this desperate, I need to do one. And sometimes life is just, you know, busy. Right now I'm renovating a rental property. I have this new job where I'm in, like, a leadership position, and my boss tells me, you know, we're trying to hire another person with your same exact role and another person half-time for the role that you're covering, and any one person can't do it. So a lot of my days, I feel like I could be working, you know, 16 hours a day, but I, you know, manage, you know, between 8 and 10. And some days are just, you know, my head is spinning. And another really good practice I use is, it's time for a 10th step. I'm just going to tell this person all the things I'm resentful about, all the things I'm fearful about, all the things I'm having selfish loss about, all the dishonesty I'm thinking, and I'm just going to clear it out because I haven't been able to do, you know, 3 or 4 during the day, but I got someone at 7 p.m., and it's almost like a bigger recap, but I need to talk to somebody. I hope that helps, and Melissa, obviously, feel free to jump in if you have anything to add.
Yeah, I think everybody has their truth about who they are and what they're apt to be. I know for myself, yeah, I have obligations at work that it would be inappropriate for me, like in the middle of that roach situation, to say, excuse me, boys and girls, I'm going to go out, I'm going to, you know, go out in the hall and make some phone calls to sort of get myself back in connection with God. And I think if I look at what is a 10th step, what is the purpose of it? The purpose is to get the garbage that's in the way between me and feeling a connection to God. So when that's what I'm looking for, right? So I could not do anything about it in the moment. And so for myself, the things that slip by me during the course of a very busy, you know, service center day, I do at night. I do my nightly review with intensity, and anything that may have gone neglected during the day is certain to show up there. And because my truth is that I struggle with humility. I mean, you know, this program has taught me how to be honest about who I am and to share the things about myself that I would have otherwise wanted to hide from you. And so for myself, it is a very helpful practice for me to not keep these things to myself, because left to my own devices, I will believe that I am justified in exacting revenge against a brother-in-law who I heard talk poorly about me, or, you know, my reaction to those cockroaches were appropriate. And through the practice of inventory, through that absolute inventory practice, which involves for me sharing it with others, but more importantly, bringing it to God, I'm able, hopefully, to be better, to do better, be better. I hope that helps, Jennifer.
Thank you very much, Jennifer C., for your question today. And that will be the last question today, looking at the time. You know, thanks again, Jason and Melissa, for what you offered here today and for the program of recovery that has transformed your lives so that others can see, you know, that this is possible and it's promised to each one of us, and that you're willing enthusiastically to come and share, you know, the passion of how you implement it each and every day and everything that you do. and that your lives have become better. It was very, very clear. We are so blessed here at A Vision for You to have this in our archives now for this particular meeting. As Jason was saying, there are others that he has given here at A Vision for You, as well as Melissa. So please go and look at our library of wealth of podcast here for Sunday Special Edition and see those as well. They all tie in together. Thank you. Thank you so much for being such a blessing for A Vision for You. So what I would like to say is that we're going to close like we always do in our traditional way here at A Vision for You by reading from the big book on page 164. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.